Okay, well, I appreciate you doing this interview with us. It's really fascinating, what you do and where you've been. You know, of course, with your nomination, that's also a great story. Missouri S&T sent us out a press release during the shutdown that talked about your nomination. So, first of all, I guess initially, obviously, what does it mean to you to have such a major nomination?
Well, just to become an astronaut at all was a dream come true and something you really never thought you could achieve. It was something that was always that goal out there, but you weren't really sure that it would ever be a possibility. And then just to achieve that was an amazing experience. And then to be nominated to be in the Hall of Fame for the astronauts, which is, really reserved for a few people that have excelled or gone above and beyond in that field is just unbelievable. I don't know what I did to deserve it, but I'm very honored to have been selected.
What other famous astronauts would you join in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, people like the initial first seven astronauts. So John Glenn is in there, Neil Armstrong is in there, and a whole host of the original, early astronaut corps. And then, just select people since that time frame who've been who've gone into either higher levels of management at NASA, which is the route I took, or went into an aerospace business of some sort, or gone into academia and reached higher levels of leadership in those areas.
Do you happen to know if there are any other Missourians that are in the Hall of Fame?
I should know that, but I would have to go look and see if there are other Missourians in there. You can go to the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation page, web page, and they would list all the astronauts currently in there.
Great. I'll check into that. That's cool. Well, take me back to that time, really, when you decided, you know what? I want to be an astronaut someday. Can you take me through that, your thinking at that time?
Well, to tell the truth, originally it started when I was a child, and I in Missouri. And those first few years, we lived on a farm actually in Cassville. And my dad and I, we would sit outside at night and look at the stars because you could see stars very clearly out in the country. And it was just fascinating. I've always been fascinated with the night sky, and you could see the first satellites going around the planet and watch those moving stars, and we would talk about what they were and if you were up there what you could see and what the Earth would look like. And I think it just started that spark of interest in what it would be like to fly in space. And so all through my life, as the space program grew and we were flying people and we were going to the moon and all those things, it was just something I thought would be the ultimate job. If you could do that, you or at least I thought that would be the highest point that a person could achieve in a career. So I worked hard. I looked at the biographies of other astronauts, what it took to get there. Of course, early in the day, it was all military test pilots. But when we got to the shuttle program, the field broadened up and they took scientists and engineers, non-military types, and women for the first time. So I thought there might actually be a possibility to achieve that goal. So I just kept going to school and doing as well as I could and selecting projects at work and working on in areas that I thought would best qualify me. And ultimately, I got an interview and I got in. So it was a long time in coming, but it was well worth it.
How difficult is that process, really? Is it a pretty strenuous process to even be a part of NASA in general and an astronaut?
Well, it depends on how what you call strenuous. It's a full-time job plus, definitely that's a more than a 40-hour and of a week type job. But it's a job that people love. So we have no issues in getting people to come work for NASA because the mission is so great. That it's something that you can say, I make a widget that goes into a piece of hardware, and that's my life's work. Or you could say, hey, I help put people into space and put people on rockets and explore new worlds. And a lot of people just think that that mission is so great that they're willing to do what it takes to make that happen safely. So it's strenuous in the sense that you know that people's lives are on the line and that you're responsible for them. But it's such an impactful work, and it makes such a big difference to humanity that people love it and are willing to do whatever it takes to make it happen.
That's awesome. I want to go back to you and your dad spending time looking at the stars back in your days in Cassville. Was that kind of your thing together, you and your dad? Was it just you two? Do you have siblings mm-hmm. that were also involved? Tell me about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have one sibling, a sister who still lives in Springfield. I was more the outdoorsy type. I was probably what you would call a tomboy. I'm sure I was. I was the tree climber, and I liked to fish, and I liked to, do a lot of outdoorsy things. And my dad had an airplane, and I would go out and help him work on the plane, or at least think I was helping. I really wasn't really helping too much. And I would help plant in the garden. I helped with, we had cows, so I'd go out and help milk the cows. I was just that kind of person who liked being outside. And so we kind of just had that bond. And my sister was the more domestic type, and she liked baking and cooking, and she was kind of hanging out with my mom more. So I think it was just a natural split based on interest, personal interest, and what we like to do. So we were very close.
Okay, awesome.
That was one of the things we liked to do at night when we were done with the day's work.
So did you have all sorts of gadgets like telescopes and stuff growing up? And did you do a bunch of different like astronaut projects for school?
Yeah, I couldn't afford the telescope. But when I did take astronomy in college for the first time, I really loved looking through the telescope. And a backup plan was to be an astronomer. That was one of the many things I had on my list that I would like to do. But in school, if we had the option to choose a research project, my two favorite subjects would either be archaeology, so looking way back in history, especially in the Inca Aztec time frame and Egyptian type, archaeology, or looking out into space. So it was the deep space subjects like what are black holes, how do they work, what are quasars, things like that. So I would always choose, I would go back and forth between those two areas of interest.
I'm curious what your initial travel to space was like for you. Not many people get to experience what you have experienced, so can you take us through what you were thinking at that time, and maybe just explain it for the average Missourian, how you would describe it.
Yeah, so it takes about a year of training. So, after you're selected to be an astronaut, you go through the basic training process, which is about 2 years, or it was at the time, learning all the systems. And then you get assigned to a particular mission, which you train for. My particular mission was the last flight to the Russian Mir space station as part of a joint program. So I got to go to Russia, which was an interesting thing to get to do back in the 90s. So it was a lot different back then. Very different than being in the United States, of course, and learning the language and the culture was all fascinating. So you do all that training and you prepare yourself and you're going to meet up with another space station in space, which is just a mind-blowing kind of concept. And then you prepare yourself mentally, you prepare practically for the risk. I got my will in order and wrote letters to my children and things like that, which is probably the toughest thing of everything that you do is to try to do that. And then you go out to the Kennedy Space Center and go into quarantine, and then you're there for a week, and then you go out to the launch pad. So they get you all dressed up in your suit. You go out to the launch pad on the special van that they have. There's very few people with you because now the vehicle is fueled with many millions of gallons of fuel, or not gallons, but pounds of fuel. And it's very dangerous out there because if anything were to happen, that entire place would be gone. So they take you up on the elevator and strap you in one at a time into your seat. And of course, you're laying on your back now because the vehicle is pointed upwards, and you're on a rocket and you're pointed upwards, so you're actually lying down on your back. And everything looks very different when you climb in and you're in that position. And then you wait. They close the door, they seal you in, and everyone drives away, and then it's just, the six or seven of you who are in the rocket. And you hear the countdown process, and your heart starts beating a little faster as they start the countdown, the close countdown, at T-minus 10 seconds, your heart really starts beating quickly. And then you start hearing the engines start up at 6 minutes or 6 seconds prior to liftoff. You feel the vehicle swing back and forth as it pushes forward and straightens back up. And then you're waiting for the solid rocket motors to ignite. And when those ignite, then you know for sure that you're going to space. So it was the rumbling and the impact in your back as you get pushed off the pad. And I remember giggling, a laughter. It was involuntary. It just came out because I at that moment you realize, oh my gosh, this is really happening, going to space. Tears are rolling down my face into my ears because you're on your back. And it's not because you're afraid, it's just because you cannot believe that all those years and all those classes in school and all that patience and all that hard work, and you're finally getting to go to space. So that was just the ultimate feeling. I probably, of any flight was that first liftoff and realizing your dreams had come true.
What was the name of that mission and that shuttle? Is there a particular name?
That it was STS-91 was the mission number.
Okay.
And it was on the Space Shuttle Discovery.
Okay. How much does your suit and gear weigh, roughly? Do you know?
I would say probably around, I don't remember exactly, 40 or 50 pounds maybe.
So
something
it was a
like
little,
that.
Okay, so it's a little heavy.
Yeah, it's a little heavy.
So, and can you explain like how fast roughly the shuttle goes when you're lifting off, and just so people understand, do you know roughly how much?
Yeah, and I would have to verify this, and you can probably check online just to make sure I'm telling you accurately. But I believe by the time you clear the tower, you are going around 100 miles an hour just from the thrust of all the rockets. And then within, seconds, I'd have to go look because this is now in my history, so I'd have to go back and refresh myself on when things happen. But you exceed the speed of sound within, a couple of minutes after liftoff. And then you are going, by the time you are in space and the engines cut off, you're going 17,500 miles an hour. So it's pretty quick. And that is equivalent to about 5 miles per second on the surface of the Earth, which is faster than a bullet travels out of the gun. So it's really fast by the time the engines cut off. And that's at about 8.5 minutes into the flight.
Wow. Okay. What was the most memorable thing when you were in space that you'll never forget?
The most beautiful thing I saw was the Earth. You're very busy and you don't actually have a lot of time to look back at the planet like I thought I would when I was in my dad's lab looking up at the sky. But I think it was one particular pass that we had at going around the Earth. You go around the Earth every 90 minutes. So you see one daylight cycle, one darkness every 45 minutes. So I remember flying, we'd gone into darkness and we were flying from around England and then down across Europe and then down across Africa. So we were coming from the north and passing down through those continents. And so you could, at night, if it's very clear, you can see the lights of the cities. So we could pick out England, we could pick out London, and then you could see the English Channel, and you go and you can and see all the major cities in Europe. So we could see where Paris, for instance, and then you could come over and Italy sticks out very clearly in the Mediterranean. You can see the boot of the shape of Italy, and you could see Rome, and then you go across a very dark Mediterranean, and then you can see Israel. It's very bright and lit up, and you can see then northern Africa, and you can see Egypt and Cairo, and you can see the Nile Delta, and the snake of the Nile is all lit up, especially at the Delta end where the city is. And then as you come down across Africa, it gets very, very dark. There's not a lot of cities in northern Africa. But you can see the fires of villages and things like that. And then there are a lot of thunderstorms over Africa. And I remember watching the way the thunderstorms, the lightning in the thunderstorms would pop. And it looked kind of like the tops of the clouds looked like popcorn popping, So it was just this bright light and a strange pattern that would kind of a charge, an electrical charge would go for hundreds of miles. And you could see the lightning travel down those clouds as you followed over that. And then the moonlight on the oceans as you came out across off the continents and onto the oceans. It was just such a beautiful path that I still remember that, seeing the Earth so clearly and the way everything looks at night.
That's got to be such a neat story to tell your kids about,
Yeah. But they were really little at the time, and it's almost incomprehensible to them at the time. And then, when they get older, they're teenagers, and they're still too cool for you. So, no matter who you are, they're still too cool for you. So, yeah, maybe someday it'll all mean something more than it did when they were young.
When you told your parents that you were going to be an astronaut, I'm curious what their reaction was.
Well, so unfortunately, my parents died when I was 8 years old, and that's when we moved away from Castle. They were in an airline or airplane incident, so they passed away when I was 8. So they never knew that I got to fly to space. I think my dad would have been very proud because he was the one that would, encourage me to be strong and never give up, never quit at things. He gave me doctor's kits for Christmas presents instead of Barbie dolls. He gave me things that made me believe that I could be more than the stereotypical female role at the time, and never even think twice about it. So I think most of my success to how he made me feel about my own capabilities. So I'm hoping that he would be very proud that that kid that sat on his lap actually got to go to space and see what the world was like from there.
Wow. So was part of you going to school and going into training to be an astronaut, was some of this, did you think about this being partly in his memory then?
Sure, I always did. And I thought about him when I was in space. I took some memory from him and from my mom and took them to space. And I remember, I think I was in space the day that I was older than him when he passed away. I think I was in space that day. So it's kind of a weird feeling that that you come upon. But yeah, I do. I credit him for most of my ability to stay strong and to achieve things that were difficult and not to give up.
Well, we initially heard about this Hall of Fame nomination from Missouri S&T. Is there anything specifically that sticks out about your time at Missouri S&T that you think might be interesting for Missourians?
Yeah, I went to both Missouri S&T and Missouri Southern both did a wonderful job, I think, in educating me. I feel that the Missouri school system is excellent, and I'm not sure that everyone realizes how good it is. I even just my undergrad at a relatively small university was excellent, very good professors. And then getting into my master's program at SMU was pretty easy based on my undergrad work and how well I was trained there. I remember, and I would give kudos to my advisor, Dr. James Stouffer, who really was my guiding person at SMU. He's a professor emeritus now, and actually he sent me a congratulatory note as well, just when he heard about it. So we still actually stay in touch. I gave a seminar, and it's the first one that was a symposium named after him about maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago now. I'd have to go back and look at the date. So, and I've given the commencement speech at Missouri S&T. So I've been back there several times. So I do owe both of my Missouri universities a lot in getting me to where I am.
Excellent. Is there anything else that you think is important to mention? Oh, hey, by the way, how long were you like officially an astronaut?
Let's see. I started in 1995. I was selected in 94. Started working in 95 as an astronaut, and then I was still an official astronaut until about 2006, when I transitioned to management only. And so it was about 11 years, I guess, then something about in that time frame. And then I managed the astronaut office. I was the deputy chief of the office for a while, and then I was Director of Flight Crew Operations, which was over the astronaut office, and flight operation, aircraft operations at Johnson Space Center. And then I came up to Cleveland after that, became a center director here.
Okay. For the average person that, is not familiar with how things work in space, obviously there's the gravity situation. Can you get into what that's like? Maybe some little odd and unique things when you're in space that maybe the average person wouldn't know about?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things, which I like to do, was sleep on the ceiling, just because you could. You can never do that anywhere else. So I would always put my sleeping bag upside down and hang from the ceiling, and you're not really hanging, you're floating there. And it's kind of cool because when you wake up, your mind naturally wants to find the floor and up and down, and there really isn't one there so much. There, I mean, everything's labeled for us an up and down. The writing is in an up and down position, but it's kind of fun to let your brain figure that out. I also, when I was on that first flight at the Mir space station, the Russian space station, it was really interesting that it had it. Well, the current space station, ISS, is all up and down all the way through the space station. It's one long space station, and everything is in the same orientation. In the Mir space station, it was a hub in the middle, a spoke sticking out in different directions. So there wasn't an up and down throughout the whole space station. So if you travel from the shuttle through one of those spokes, then you would come to the center hub, and from there you would have to find which other spoke you wanted to go into. And it was always just a brain-teasing experience to figure out up and down in each one of those spokes, because you'd come to the center, and then you'd have to figure out which way you would turn your body so that you could come into a room right side up. And if you come into a room or one of those sections upside down, it's very disorienting for a minute because your brain just is not used to not knowing which way is up and down. So it was always, I would always try to practice going into a room the right way and almost always turn, make a turn the wrong way or, you'd be 90 degrees off or something. And you come into a room, you just have to stop, come to a screeching halt and just figure out which way in that particular room was up and down so that you could orient yourself so that you could, find what you needed to find. But it's funny just sitting in that hub looking in one direction, you'd see somebody that looked like they were on the ceiling, and then, looking to your left, it would look like somebody was walking on the wall on a treadmill, and to your right, it would look like somebody was on the opposite wall doing an experiment. It was just a really interesting environment to be in, just to watch how gravity just didn't matter in space.
So is there like a certain like weight limit astronauts have are required to meet then since there's the gravity issue?
Well, it's not weight for the gravity issue once you're in space. It's weight for the liftoff of the rocket because every pound that you lift off the planet has a cost to it. It's like, I don't know what it is today, but it was like $20,000 a pound to lift something off the planet. And the actual just physical size of the spacesuits, they only have certain sizes of spacesuits, and they only have certain stress limits on the seats and the vehicles for safety purposes. So the shuttle had a pretty broad range of weight. You could be 6'4" and 220 pounds and still be okay. In the Soyuz, it's much smaller, so the size limit is much less to be in a Soyuz. And I don't work on the on the crew capsule, the Orion program, and I don't recall what their weight limits are on the Orion program, which is the next capsule that NASA is building. But it's still a smaller cockpit than the shuttle had, so it's probably a little bit less than what it was to be in the shuttle. But I'd have to check what that would be. I don't know it off the top of my head.
Okay. Do you get invited to speak or do any sort of, I guess, training or anything like that for Missouri Southern or Missouri S&T?
Yeah, I have. Like I said, I've given commencement speeches actually at both, and I have gone back. I've received honors from both schools, and I receive more invitations than I can actually accommodate because I have... As you might guess, there's a lot of requests to speak at many universities and many conferences and things like that around the world all the time. So we do the best we can, but I have to manage that along with the actual responsibilities of my job. So that's all on top of my regular job, which is running a center of 3,000 people and cutting-edge research. So I just try to balance it all out and do the speaking engagements when I can, but I unfortunately cannot accept every single one.
Okay. Well, I think I've taken up enough of your time. I know you're a very busy person, so I appreciate you taking 30 minutes with us to talk about this, and this has been very fascinating. I always enjoy speaking with you, so thank you very much, and we'll be watching for the results. Is it in March or April?
It's April 6th, I believe, the first Saturday in April.
First
I think that's it. So yeah, that's the day of the induction.
Is that going to be like in Florida, or where would that be?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it's at the Kennedy Visitor Center in Florida. That's where the Astronaut Hall of Fame is specifically located.
Okay.
So the ceremony will be there. I think the induction actually occurs that morning. And it's open to the public. And then there's a gala afterwards, which is not free. You can buy tickets to it. But the morning part, I believe, is open to the public.
Okay. Okay. Janet, thank you very much for this. I really appreciate this.
And you're
I think
welcome.
I think a lot of Missourians are going to really enjoy listening to this.